So it will be the three of us attempting to sort of weave together our different perspectives on a very large and sort of hard to grapple with paradigm shift that is taking place in the way the Western mind does its business with reality. And, you know, it may be the last paradigm shift we ever get. So when this cat lands, it's going to have to land on its feet, because immediately facing it will be the theater of activity that is the consequence of the old way of doing it, which was a very bad way of doing it. So we have to be prepared for a whole new dynamic, a whole new way of linking systems together, thinking about solutions, thinking about the past and ourselves in the world.
Okay. Right, well, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. As you've all gathered, I'm here with my wife, Jo.
Where is she?
Oh, there she is. I just said I was here with you, and you vanished, but then you appeared just on cue. And with our little boy, Merlin, who you may see around, he's nearly two, and with our babysitter from England, who's called Mandy, who's just 18. 6 weeks ago, she was in a her village in Yorkshire, and then she came to work with us and didn't realize that within a few weeks she'd be at Esalen. Well, she's here too. I'm a biologist by background. I studied biology because I was interested in animals and plants. And when I was studying it at Cambridge, I began to have terrible doubts about what I was doing, because everything that really interested me about animals and plants somehow vanished when I got into the biochemistry laboratories. I was majoring in biochemistry, and I did a PhD in biochemistry there. But there's a curious thing about biochemistry. You're doing biochemistry to study the molecular basis of life, yet the very first thing you do in the laboratory is kill whatever you're studying, grind it up, extract the enzymes, and then in a test tube, study the properties of some of these molecules extracted from this killed organism. And it began to occur to me that perhaps this wasn't the best way to understand life. But I didn't quite know what to do about it, because everybody else thought it definitely was the best way to study life, and in fact there was no other valid way. So this set me thinking, and I then came to realize there was a whole tradition of biology called vitalism, which had tried to adopt a totally different approach to the understanding of life, a school which flourished in the 19th century and which went on till the 1920s. When it underwent a transformation into the organismic or holistic philosophy of nature, which really treats the whole of the universe as alive. This was a totally new idea, a new perspective for me. And I began to see that the science of biology could be reformed, that this idea that living organisms are truly alive rather than being just machines, that's the official doctrine, the mechanistic theory, says living organisms are just complicated machines. Believe it or not, still the official doctrine of academic biology and academic medicine. And this set up a tremendous tension, and I began to see there was a new way of doing it, and I began to see the outlines of a new theory. I had several insights into how this might happen. I stayed at Cambridge for about 7 or 8 years doing research. Then I went to India, where I worked in an agricultural institute. These ideas went on developing. I then saw how I could bring them all together in a synthesis and into a new way of seeing how biology could be done. And I wrote a book while still in India called A New Science of Life. In it, the basic idea I'm suggesting is that there's a kind of inherent memory in all kinds of animals and plants. Each species has its own collective memory. So each member of the species draws on this collective memory and in turn contributes to it. This means that the instincts of animals, for example, the behavior of cuckoos, the spinning of webs by spiders, are like a memory, a habit of the species. This inheritance takes place by the process I call morphic resonance, by a kind of invisible, intangible memory. a kind of resonance between present and past organisms of the same kind. The same theory helps explain how our own memory works by a resonance between our own past and our present states. It leads to the idea that our memories aren't stored in our brains, but that we're tuning into them by this process of morphic resonance. Anyway, this theory, which I'd been developing, as the more research I did, the better fit I found it made with the facts. I found there was already considerable circumstantial evidence for this idea. But as you can imagine, this idea wouldn't be very popular in the realms of academic biochemistry. And it didn't win over instantly all my colleagues in the biochemistry department at Cambridge either. So when my book on this subject was published, which I wrote in India, there was a considerable controversy in the scientific world. The theory is testable by experiment. Various experiments have been done. It is being tested. I've been developing and working on this theory for the last 10 years. My last book, The Presence of the Past, that came out recently, develops it in more detail. And currently I'm writing a book called The Rebirth of Nature, which is about the idea that the entire cosmos is alive rather than just inanimate and mechanistic. What difference that makes. Well, when A New Science of Life came out in 1982 in America, it came out a year earlier in England, I came to California because it was published in Los Angeles by Tatcha. I'd never been to California before. And I suddenly found myself in a wonderland which I hadn't even thought about. I'd lived in India for the previous 7 years. Before that, I'd spent most of my time in Cambridge, England. I had been educated in America at Harvard, spent a year there doing philosophy. But California was something that I hadn't even dreamed of. I found myself here at Esalen. I found an extraordinary new range of things going on I hadn't known about. And when I was in San Francisco, a friend who I knew from Europe said to me, just the day before I left, there's somebody you must meet. He's called Terence McKenna. He said, you get on this bus in San Francisco, you get off at Santa Rosa 2 hours later, and Terence will appear in a large 1956 Buick or whatever. and that'll be Terence McKenna. I didn't know much about Terence, so I went up there, and in this large 1956 Buick, we headed off into the woods in Sonoma County, where Terence lives. And there I met both Terence and Ralph, who was there for the day. We had a most interesting time. I found that part of my interest in these other realms of reality, of course, like many people in this room, was stimulated by experience with psychedelic substances. This was before I went to India. When I arrived in India, I found that India is a kind of psychedelic realm anyway. You know, it's just an amazing place. So in Terence, I found somebody who knew about that whole realm, who shared with me an interest in India, since it played an important part in his development, and who had views about the nature of reality which complemented my own in an extraordinary way. My own theory is about memory and habit in nature. Terence, I found, had developed a theory about novelty and creativity in nature, a theory about the quality of time and the creative process as it is related to the ongoing flux of events. And Ralph had a kind of mathematical theory, which was just the kind of thing that the view of nature I was trying to develop needed, the idea of nature being drawn by goals or attractors. In the mathematical science of dynamics, there's this model of of reality being pulled from ahead by things called attractors. It's a teleological, animistic view of nature, which dressed up in the guise of mathematical models, which I found most fascinating. And so for me, the meeting with Ralph and Terence was a step further towards seeing how one could begin to dream of a world in which nature was seen as alive, in which the imagination permeated all reality, in which animals and plants are seen as part of the living texture, the living components, the cells and the life of Gaia, and Gaia in the life of the cosmos as a whole. In fact, a view of the world as alive, which recalls in some respects the old cosmologies of the ancient world, where the cosmos was seen as a living organism, where they thought of the whole cosmos as having a soul, the soul of the world, the anima mundi. And so I found Terence and Ralph both people who were interested in looking at trying to form a new understanding of what we could call the soul of the world. So our discussions over the years, over the last 7 years, have spun around many aspects of these things. And when the idea came up of us coming here together at Esalen to do something together in public, we've so far talked a great deal in private and react synergistically in a way that I've found extremely stimulating and inspiring. When this opportunity came up, I was delighted that it was possible to be here, and I'm delighted you're all here. And what we're hoping to do is to talk about aspects of the world soul. And it turned out when we were discussing this, each of us seemed to be representing a principle. And these three principles in interaction form a kind of trinity. And the structure of our trialogue is going to reflect the different interactions of those principles. The principle which I'm representing is the principle of evolutionary creativity. How is it that the whole of nature is somehow creative in an evolutionary sense? The basis of my entire theory suggests that the laws of nature are not fixed eternal truths that have always been there, but habits which have evolved in the course of evolution itself. So I think there's a kind of habit principle in nature. There must also be a creative principle in nature to give the universe its evolutionary and yet regular way of behaving. So in these trilogues, I'm going to be representing the principle of evolutionary creativity, the evolutionary principle, including the habit that builds up and the creation that leads to new forms.
Well, in many ways, my history is similar to Rupert's, in many ways different. I think what we share most notably was a very early involvement in nature and a fascination with what used to be called natural history, which means bugs, rocks, butterflies, and stars. And my own life has not been particularly academic. I graduated from the University of California, but managed to stretch the degree-taking process out over 12 years that went from 1965 to whatever that is. And a lot of traveling in India. I thought I was an art historian. In my early LSD experiences, I seemed to see motifs and structures that gave me an interest in Tibetan Buddhism. And I went to India with the intent of studying the Tibetan language and quickly found that the whole thing was just overwhelming. And that I was just, you know, a human atom in the sea of India, and that the notion of encompassing or understanding what this was clearly the task of a lifetime. And several times in my life, I have acted out this sort of ricocheting relationship between the humanities and the sciences, at times, you know, losing myself in the study of certain schools of poetry or literature or painting, and then at other times spending years reading philosophy of science and epistemic basis of physics and this sort of thing, always trying to get a resolution on the content of my experience, my lived experience, which included the psychedelic experience, which for me, from very early on, was this kind of tremendous mystery or conundrum which was set down in the middle of my being. And it still continues like that. I keep returning to that, testing all deep ideas against the fullness of experience that that represents. Well, for me, just having the sort of mind that I do, this meant model building and an interest in the models of others. And in the 1970s, I carried out a critique of scientific method and the implicit philosophical assumptions of science, and convinced myself that it was pretty much just whistling past the graveyard, that they, you know, it was all done with smoke and mirrors. The actual understanding of what it means to be a living, thinking organism is nowhere tangential to what science is telling us about the world. And so I became interested then in revisioning causality. It seemed to me that the problem lay somewhere with the definition of time, that there had been a misunderstanding. And I, of course, when you read dissident views on time, or when you did in the 50s and 60s, you read Carl Jung, who wrote about what was called synchronicity, which he called an acausal connecting principle. And I spend a lot of time on that, but it isn't ultimately satisfying. If you analyze it carefully, it isn't ultimately an explanation. It's more like a counter-mapping. It tells you that connectedness can occur differently than in the stream of cause and effect, but it doesn't exactly explain to you why this is. So then I became interested in other views of time and elaborated my own theory, which Rupert mentioned, about novelty. I began to see that what I was groping toward was the notion that time is not a flat plane, but it's some kind of topological manifold, some kind of surface over which events flow, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, in the same way that water makes its way over a landscape. And where flow is rapid, phase transitions occur and turbulence enters the picture. And turbulence is mathematically a very different creature from laminar flow. Ralph is an expert on all of this. But anyway, I wanted to follow very deeply and to its ultimate conclusions this notion that what we had left out of our model of the world was the idea that time is actually composed not of a homogeneous medium, but of some set of elements or interconnected parts which are in flux. And out of this, I created progressively more and more formal models. And they were like novelty engines. And before the word fractals was even invented, these curves, these recursive equations that I was working with, were in fact fractal, of the fractal type. So I think what's happening, you know, is there's a general awareness of a need for new mathematical objects and new models of process to connect up the world in a meaningful way. I think it was P.W. Bridgman in one of his essays said that a coincidence is what you have left over when you apply a bad theory. You know, if you're getting a lot of coincidences after you get your theory in place, then maybe the theory is not so good. Well, our world is haunted by coincidence. The main difference between our world and the world that science tells us we're living in is that science denies the quirky, freaky, cosmic giggle, high-plottedness, completely improbable, totally quirky humor that binds everything together and that makes it something other than an engine in which atoms blindly run, in Whitehead's phrase. Well, this kind of thinking and looking for colleagues and support led me first to Ralph, who was great, good support, but, you know, he held my hand long years before I even thought I understood him. I'm not sure I understand him now. And by him, I mean only the tiny iota of him, which is this crusty little theory out of which we make our bread. Rupert, I read The New Science of Life and had read all the other radical biology which preceded it and knew that there hadn't been anything for 15 years, that, you know, Schrodinger brilliantly anticipated the discovery of DNA, and then Joseph Needham and L.L. White, and, well, Eric Jansch should be mentioned, actually, as a precursor of us all, I think. I mean, Eric Jansch was a great pioneer, a great soul, and he saw very deeply into whole systems, as did Ilya Prigozhin, the Belgian thermodynamicist. And I think a lot of all of what we're doing comes out of that. What Prigozhin showed that just brought down the house was that there could be perturbations of physical systems that were unpredictable and that would cause the whole system to actually move to a more ordered state than the initial state. And this perturbation to higher states of order looks suspiciously like a violation of the supposedly inviolate second law of thermodynamics. So that looks, you know, like a doorway into an energetic hyperspace, somehow a way around the no free lunch rule. We'll talk more about this, but these guys, Prigozhin and Jansch, anticipated and were in many ways inspirational to what we all are doing. So then, before I hand this on to Ralph, in terms of the way the weekend will be structured and to give us something to hang all this on, Rupert mentioned the triadic structure of the dialogues and that he would be representing the creative evolutionary impulse. I will represent the divine imagination, the imagination, a la William Blake. In other words, this domain, this legacy of the human mind in which culture and dream and personal and historical aspiration takes place. We're seeing all of these things as aspects of the world's soul. You see, the notion of morphogenesis, the notion of fields that shape form, eventually this question of how intelligent is the world soul, or how mind-like is the Gaian control system, is just going to give way to the perception that the answer lies probably to the left of, well, more mind-like than yourself, because it is not we who are in a position to define these things. So the notion of the world soul is properly vivified and pictured and endowed with qualities and properties that are exponential. So I will take that position. My great concern, as far as these dialogues is concerned, is novelty, the emergence of the unpredictable and the truly new out of the background of the recursive and iterative processes of nature. How can there be novelty, and what exactly is it? And since very clearly we are the cutting edge of its self-expression, then unraveling this question about what is novelty is going to take us very close to the question of what is human nature? what are we doing in this phase space? What is the nature of the turbulence that we necessarily have to describe as ourselves?